Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, everyone. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast here, only this is going to be a two-part podcast because, frankly, we had so much to talk about that we don't want to make you all go slightly mad listening to us rambling on for an hour and three quarters. So, the first half is going to be mostly concerned with the Europa League and Champions League finals, for which Helen will be joining me. And then, me and Helen in the second part, which you can follow up later, we'll be discussing the season as a whole, Unai Emery and how he's done to date, and what we think should and what we think will happen next. Plus, we discuss Aaron Ramsey's contract, Mesut Ozil, and much more besides. Hope you enjoy them both. Hello again, listeners. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast, and I'm joined this week in what's been a testing week, a trying week for us all, but with some light at the end of the tunnel, at least a little smidgen of light. And to join me in discussion of all these things is Helen Trantum stroke Carpenter, depending on which surname she wants to go with to this week. What do you
No, I'm Trantum still in the Arsenal world, because Trantum is my Arsenal heritage, and secondly, it keeps me safe from the work connection. So
in that case, this is Helen Trantum. As someone who lives in a household with divided loyalties, yeah. I imagine this week was quite a weird emotional experience for you.
Indeed. I mean, I'm sure everyone will have seen the polls doing the rounds before the start of the week, saying, well, if you had a choice between Arsenal winning and Spurs winning this week versus neither, which would you choose? And I've got to be honest, the appeal of a year of Champions League football is not worth the sacrifice of a lifetime of gloating Spurs fans, in my book.
But particularly as you live with one.
Exactly. It's all a little bit too close to home. So, I'd rather us just take an extra season to get back to the big time.
Well, also the general viewpoint on that particular vote was a very divided one, wasn't it? It was a bit sort of Brexit in terms of the division amongst the Gunner population as to.
I think it was slightly stronger view than Brexit. I think it was something like 75-25 in general on the various polls I've seen for not over my dead body, Spurs winning the Champions League. So, there is that.
So can we say that Arsenal were just giving the people what they want?
Well, I mean, that does presuppose some sort of connection between the two results, whereas, you know, clearly in an ideal world, we'd still have won on Wednesday without needing to sacrifice that in order to achieve Saturday's result.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to admit, I very much disassociated the two concepts in my mind, because I was very confident of Spurs' ability to not win the Champions League final, and I figured that we desperately needed a result in the game that we didn't get one. But no doubt we'll talk about that in just a moment.
And ironically, both games were decided, to a certain extent, by penalty decisions relatively early on.
Well, I think also both games were fundamentally decided by who was better in the final third compared to who was better in the middle third. In both games, you know, in the Europa League final, Chelsea's defenders significantly outperformed our own, particularly in central defence. In the Champions League final, Spurs had lots of possession and chances and promising positions, but until the last 5 minutes, even later than Arsenal's brief flurry, they didn't look like they were going to score at all, whereas Liverpool played like trash but looked like they might score every time they got into a decent position, which is ultimately, it shows, doesn't matter necessarily how well you play, you've just got to take advantage of those key moments, which sadly, in the first of the two fixtures, did not go our way. Well, before coming on air, you discussed your sense of, and no doubt increasing during the match, sense of apathy towards the Europa League final. I mean, how did you find the game itself, and was that apathy the result of the build-up or the season as a whole, or was it just because the game was so turgid?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I wasn't nervous before Wednesday rolled around in the first place. which is unusual in the week building up to a final. I start to get a bit, particularly given what was at stake on this as a one-off game, usually I would start to get very itchy feet in the run-up to the game. And also because it's against Chelsea, you know, if it'd been against a European side, you might have felt a bit differently, but it just had a feel of yet another game almost. And then we actually had a family bereavement on the afternoon of the match. And I have never felt like football was less important in my life.
Well, with good reason, yeah.
When you consider what's at stake, I found it really bizarre to watch a football game thinking, not I don't care about the outcome, but if this doesn't go the right way, it's never going to have had less impact on my life. Like, usually if Arsenal lose, that's me gone for, like, days. I'm grumpy, I'm miserable, I'm angry at things, you know? Mm. Particularly if people start criticising us. If I feel it's warranted, it's almost worse, because then I feel I have to get more defensive about it. So, I mean, it was just a really odd feeling. I'm not, you know... The only other final that we've been in that I felt anywhere close to that was the League Cup final against Man City, where I think most people went into that game thinking, well, you know, it's a one-off game, anything can happen, but realistically, we're likely to get smashed here.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, Jesus, I mean, from what you and your family are going through, it's no surprise that the game, even without all the weirdness surrounding it, would seem utterly unimportant. We do all get very emotionally involved in everything around our football clubs, but of course, when you compare it to real life stuff, it very quickly becomes unimportant.
No, exactly, exactly. And
I mean, I wonder if also the inability of the game to sort of draw you back into it from that position was also partly influenced by the kind of weirdness around the game itself as well, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean,
isn't it really?
Yeah.
Because usually most people view football as it's a distraction. That's basically the whole point of it. It allows you to get away from like the everyday stresses of your life, or you know, to feel part of something bigger than just you. And yet, actually, I just felt really detached from the whole thing. It felt like, although it was Arsenal officially on the pitch, we were missing a player. We were missing basically all of our fans. I mean, in the nicest possible way, I might actually have been in anywhere other than Azerbaijan for the match, had the final taken place somewhere else, rather than at home with my family.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean,
it just felt like almost like it wasn't us that we were watching.
Well, I think also, you know, even from the perspective of obviously someone who didn't have anything else in their life at that moment in time, or at least not of any great significance, the fact, you know, that we've already talked at length about the ridiculous situation that UEFA have created, and of course the fact that Mkhitaryan wasn't able to be there, and no fans were able to be there, and the majority of the two-thirds full ground was full of people who were totally ambivalent towards either team, did mean that...
Worse than ambivalent, turned up in one kit and then left in a different one.
Well, yeah. But I mean, sort of even watching it on the telly, it was very strange, because the only nerves I had, normally, as you say, you get nervous about the game itself. The only nerves I had were about consequences. The game itself, I was like, you know, I want us to win because of what it would represent for the club and their ability to address some of the issues that they've got. But in terms of the game itself, even though the idea, you know, in the days leading up to it, I was quite excited by it. But when the day itself arrived and then the game started, I found myself, I just wanted to get through it and hope that we got the right outcome. But I didn't really want to watch it. and I just felt...
Yeah, it didn't really feel like there was... It didn't feel like there was a way to win almost. It was like, well, if we win the match, everyone will say, well, it's only the Europa League and we'll get into the Champions League by the back door. But people will be like, well, Chelsea had nothing to play for, whereas for you, it was like your game of the season. And if we lost, obviously, then that was fairly disastrous anyway.
Yeah, I mean, one has to draw the comparison with a recent occasion in which, thanks to you, I was able to be at the match to see us beat Chelsea in the FA Cup final, which, you know, remains one of my... better days of being a football fan. Certainly, certainly in the in the top 10 all time football moments for me. And so again, I thank you for that. But that was, you know, even if I had not been at the ground, it would have felt something significant. Whereas this became this the entire thing just seemed like an exercise in trying to avoid a negative outcome rather than trying to achieve a positive one. In a way, it seems, I don't know if it's the Europa League as well, because I remember the Europa League final when we lost to Galatasaray, which just was one of the most meh footballing experiences of the last 30 years that I've had. You know, I remember being more excited seeing us draw 0-0 at home to Luton Town, for Christ's sake. Yeah, it's sort of the atmosphere, the fact that it felt so after the Lord Mayor's show, the fact that the Europa League is a competition. The only reason you want to win the Europa League is so you don't have to be in the Europa League next year.
Exactly. It's like an irony in itself, isn't it?
And so this sort of... And then, of course, the ground being as it was and the game not being great, both teams looking rusty, although I will say that in the second half, Chelsea looked like they had played a slightly more competitive fixture in the intervening time than any of the other teams in finals this week, which, of course, they did do, hence the injury to Loftus-Cheek. It was a great send-off for Eden Hazard. I don't know, we'll touch on that, but it still sort of had a feeling of a massive non-event.
Yeah, I think both teams were decidedly average, to be honest. I mean, we obviously had a lot more of the ball first half. Chelsea couldn't connect two passes together. Their touch and their passing was absolutely horrific. And I said at half-time, you know, surely they can't be this bad second half.
Well, and indeed.
Lo and behold, they came out, played the same way, but actually put some of those passes together. And it only takes about three passes to get beyond our defence these days.
Well, it's also that... I mean, you know, I was talking to my girlfriend, who is not interested in football particularly, and occasionally humours me by being willing to listen to such things when it's a game of significance. And I said, and she was sort of wondering why I was a bit sort of worried at half time when the game had been, you know, fairly uneventful. And I said essentially because Chelsea probably won't be that bad again, and even if they are, they've got the one player on the pitch who's most likely to achieve something out of nothing, and he happens to be. Playing mostly in an area where we are likely to experience something negative happening at our end, and not down to the
anywhere across our back five, that would be them.
Well, true, but it's also it's also you know, this isn't to criticise him, but Maitland-Niles is a player playing out of position in a position he's played for about half a season.
Where I actually thought he was having a pretty good game up until he committed, obviously, the rather naive foul for the pen.
Well, he was until, for me, he was right up until Chelsea got their goals. And I don't even blame him for the first two, even though he was caught out of position and for both of them. The first one, he was trying to overcompensate for other people not doing their jobs elsewhere. And the second one, he was probably fouled and therefore out of position for the ball to come in. But they never showed a replay of that. Yeah, but I did see a number of people suggesting, including neutrals, suggesting it was probably a foul. But ultimately, even if he had been in the right position, you know, Eden Hazard, there's a reason why Real Madrid are willing to pay 120 million plus for a bloke whose contract runs out next year, because he is one of the best, has been one of the best players in England for the last. You know, not every match and not always consistency, but when he plays well, he is one of the best players in the country. And he was always going to be super motivated for this game. And all it took is for Chelsea to give him some form of platform by pulling some other players around out of position and by getting him to combine with Giroud, which is always going to be their game plan. So that was always the worry. You know, I said to people last week, I said, if we can keep Hazard quiet, I think we'll win. If we can't, we won't.
Yeah, but I have to say, I think there's far more significance that should be attached to scoring the first goal, actually, than the quality of Hazard's performance. Because,
of course, yeah.
Whilst he played better than our players in general, I'm not sitting here thinking, my God, he had a worldie, he was unplayable.
No. You know.
And the way they were banging on about him after the game, I mean, I can't confess to having kept the television on, but, you know, on the radio for days afterwards, oh, Ozil was terrible, Hazard was brilliant. Well, Ozil was so-so in a team of so-so performances.
But the thing is, I mean, that comparison is just made because of people are looking at pay packets and reputations and.
Well, and quite, and one player is an individual designed to create that moment of magic,
yeah,
without needing so much support from his teammates. Whereas the other is a player who is effectively made to grease the wheels of his more sort of show off type. Show off's the wrong word, but you know, the people who make the final touch.
Yeah, I suppose one of the reasons why everyone was wanking off over Hazard is because, as you say, he wasn't actually great, but he still had some really decisive moments in the match. And the fact is he created space for his teammates to have an easier time of things, just because, unsurprisingly, the Arsenal defence, as most defences are, when he gets the ball at his feet and start running, everyone shits themselves, and they've suddenly got three people surrounding him, and then the next thing you know that the left wing back or whoever is in 10 yards of space because everyone's gone to Hazard because they know that he can run through your team. And I suppose, without making a comparison with Ozil, because they are such different players, it did show a fundamental thing that was lacking in our team, which is, as has been the case for a number of years, we don't have anyone who can equate to that threat.
Yeah.
And the fact is because of that.
Oh, you could go back through about 5 years of Daily Canon articles, Matthew, and find me writing on the subject. For me, it's not even about that player. It's like Zaha, right, for Crystal Palace. It's not even about what he does. It's about the fact that the whole team gets so many more opportunities because people are scared of him.
Exactly. Exactly. And you're right, you know, on the website here, and I'm sure lots of other websites elsewhere, have been banging on about the desperate need for a player who can play wide but drift centrally and can beat people, because...
But like Alexis Sanchez of the first 6 months he was at Arsenal, before we decided that instead of beating people, he'd just run into them.
Well, Alexis is not in that direction, but he's only a player that could ever beat one or two players max in a run. You want someone that you...
Oh, yeah, it's definitely an element of fortune about his dribbling rather than supreme technical ability, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you're...
The Jack Wilshere school of dribbling.
A little bit, yeah, yeah. Only with less chance of having his ankle broken by some dirty fucker coming in clattering him. But, basically, if you... You know, this isn't like going back to the 80s or the 90s. Teams are so tactically well set up these days. If you don't have anyone that can force them to be put out of their tactical setup, it's very, very hard to break things down. And I think
a degree of unpredictability, isn't it? I mean, you say goals change games, and actually, you know, you won't have a defender who knows their opponent any more closely than Laurent Koscielny marking Olivier Giroud.
Mm.
And yet, it was the unpredictability of Giroud bending down to steer a header in, you know, I don't know, a foot and a half off the ground, caught Koscielny out, and that's the goal, actually, that really changed the game. You know, that gave Chelsea confidence.
Mm.
And you could see, I've never seen an Arsenal team concede one goal and instantly just drop their heads as badly as we did on Wednesday. It was literally like the hope just disappeared.
I would say that it's a combination of a couple of things. There's definitely that. And I'd say that this, unfortunately, has been something that has afflicted this team for a few years now. But it's also the fact that rather than taking a more tactically intelligent approach and sort of retaining structure and trying to build back into a game, which is what you'd normally do in that situation, because basically everyone knows our defence is creaking badly, they sort of go into panic mode and think, well, we've got to equalise like immediately before we concede another one, which of course invariably makes you much more likely to concede another one because you lose your shape, and Chelsea were able to pick us off. And of course, when you give Hazard time and space to run into, it's like, hello, here comes trouble. I think also with on the Giroud goal, which is, I mean, a brilliant header, I mean, Jesus, we have to admit it, but he scored that goal not just because of his unpredictable movement, but also because, unfortunately, despite his heroic comeback from injury, over the last few weeks, Koscielny's legs are gone.
Like, because guess what? We have to play him in every game of any consequence, because he's our only centre-half who, even half fit, looks halfway decent.
And the problem
is... I think Monreal stunk the place out on Wednesday. Since he came back from injury, I've been incredibly underwhelmed. And that's a player that, when he first joined Arsenal... He drove me up the wall. And he played so well that he actually managed to turn that around in my head, which is quite impressive, because once I've got a down on a player, that's I've nailed my colours to the wall a little bit. But then the second half of this season in particular, it's like he's just fallen off a cliff.
Yeah, and I think it was
diving in when he shouldn't. He's not reading the game. I mean, that's such a crucial part of his game, because he hasn't got electric pace.
Yeah, yeah.
So he needs to read it right and intercept it right to make the difference. And instead, he's lost that ability, you know, to read the game, to intercept. And instead, he's lunging in too early. He's then caught way out of position, because obviously he's lunging in and not getting the ball. Mm. And then that's leaving Koscielny in particular very exposed, because instead of being one of two centre-halves in a two, he's a centre-half in the middle of a three who suddenly has no one outside him. And he's got to cover a hell of a lot more ground, because in theory he's got, you know, half a pitch which Monreal's vacated plus part of the other half that he's also supposed to be covering, because the wider centre-half, in this case Socrates, is wider because he's in the three. And that was exposed a number of times on Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think Nacho, as you say, had won a lot of people around after a bit of an underwhelming start. And I think particularly the 16-17 season, I thought he was really, really good. And I thought 17-18, he was good for the most part. But this year, and at the very end of last season, I think basically he started struggling with some injuries. He hasn't looked entirely fit. He's lost a tiny bit of what pace he had, and his composure's gone a bit. And we still don't know if his contract has been actually renewed or not with the 1 year extension clause. So we may or may not be seeing him again. But it'd be fair to say that, I mean, it's very, very difficult. This is something I've got a great deal of sympathy for, because a lot of people have been very critical of Unai Emery and the tactics, and no doubt we'll discuss those shortly. But my sympathy is like, he doesn't really have any options, because he's with Bellerin injured and Holding injured. Like, he's trying to, the defence is held together with like sellotape. I mean, you've got Maitland-Niles, who isn't a fullback, who can do a job there. You got Lichtsteiner, who can't run anymore. You got Jenkinson, who can only run in straight lines. And then on the left side, you've got Monreal, whose legs are going, and Kolasinac, who just can't track a runner to save his life. And then at centre-half, you've got Koscielny, who has had to play himself once again into the ground when he can't play that often. Socrates, who's been decent, but is a second centre-half, if you will, because he lacks the composure needed to be the lead man. And Mustafi, who's like a walking fuck-up, you know, who plays really great for 85 minutes and then does stupid shit for the next 5 minutes. And so Emery's having to play five at the back, just because, like, can you imagine the defence we've got at the moment with four at the back?
No, but to be fair, if he'd wanted to play four, he could easily have dropped Kolasinac off the pitch.
Well, yeah, I mean, we wouldn't really have noticed the difference, given Kolasinac.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Kolasinac had the potential to have to create our best chances, but he bottled playing the ball when he should have done.
Yeah, well, I think the first one, which everyone was very critical of, where he should have put the ball in, basically he got his fate wrong, and he had to control it because he couldn't have hit it in stride, because he basically, his stride pattern was completely wrong. And then and then after that, the second one, I think you're right, I think he bottled the chance to put the ball in early. And in terms of the first half, that was two of our four best opportunities. The first one particularly, because obviously the Chelsea defence was really out of position.
It didn't even need to be an especially good cross, it just needed to go across.
And the chance was wasted. And I agree, we could have played a back four, but given how porous our back five was, I'm sort of worried about how a back four would have, you know. I think if Hector Bellerin was fit, we might have seen the four diamond two that we saw at the Emirates against Chelsea, even in the absence of Aaron Ramsey, because Ozil, you know, despite the fact he had a pretty shit second half, sacrificed his game to try and do a job on Jorginho to a degree in the first half, although obviously he lacks the aggression that someone like Ramsey would bring to make that more effective.
Well, I think that's the point, isn't it? Ozil put in my view, actually quite a solid performance in terms of doing what he was expected defensively, tracking the man, making a couple of tackles, blocking the channels, but it came at a cost because then he wasn't quite as available as he would usually be going forwards.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, I thought in the first half, Ozil was a 6, 6.5 out of 10, one of the better players on the pitch. But in the second half, unfortunately, as we got overran, he got less of the ball, but also his decision making on the ball suffered in the second half. I thought we also saw in the second half one of the things which is, you know, obviously the main negativity towards Ozil is his salary and his body language and his taking 5 minutes to walk off the fucking pitch when we're losing a game. But the massive issue for me is that he's playing the ball slower than he was before, and
since he's joined Arsenal, he plays the ball slower than he ever did at Real Madrid. You know, I know when he joined, we watched highlight reels of him like charging down the wing, picking out Ronaldo in the middle on a counter attack. I can't remember the last counter attack I watched and thought, "Oh, Ozil's going to pass this ball quickly and get us going." He almost always slows attacks like that up. But I think that's symptomatic of who he is. I think he's the type of player who can make the difference in really tight games. But he's not a player who, when you're 1-2-0 down, is going to be the player to pick you up by the scruff of the neck and say, "Right, I'm going to fix this, job done."
Which is sort of what Fabregas alluded to in the studio afterwards, when he was sort of basically saying, you know, Ozil's a brilliant footballer, but I'm not sure he's someone you can... who's going to lead a team. He's someone that can make a team work better. But
yeah, when you think back to Fabregas in the game, I think it was against Aston Villa.
Yep.
We were 1-0 down, injured, had a hamstring injury, came off the bench. I think he played about 11 minutes in total, scored 2 goals and then got subbed off again.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe scored 2 and created a third. It was something like that. By the time he went off, we were comfortable again, and he was probably out for another 3 weeks or something. But...
Yeah, I mean that is one of the things, you know. Now that Fabregas has left Chelsea, we can start a little bit of the revisionism and needs, you know. The reason why Fabregas was so loved was not just because he was a great footballer, but also because he had
a bit of fire in his belly.
Yeah, exactly.
He was prepared to kick someone to get what he wanted.
But also, I think with Ozil as well, like I think in the first couple of years with us, we saw some of the, or 3 years maybe, we saw some of the player that was at Real Madrid. I mean, I think particularly of the 15-16 season, you know, there were periods of that season where he was playing with great pace. It was partly because he had a good partnership with Alexis, but, you know, I thought he was playing at a really high
level. I'm not saying he was shit.
No, I'm not saying you were, but
that,
I'm just
that's
saying...
That's just me saying that the speed of his play, his play within a counter-attacking setup. Didn't seem to fit.
But
because
I think it's
20 yards out with players ahead of him who are actually moving, because our off the ball movement in the last, I'd like to blame Emery, but I think it's actually been over 2 or even 3 seasons.
I'd agree.
He's just declined to the point of being non-existent.
Well, part of the problem is which is also impacting on Ozil, is again this same thing as where's the wide players? And so the only off the ball movement you're getting is either Ramsey running from deep or a striker trying to pull out wide. And that is the off-the-ball movement. I mean, that's the one thing I'll say that Emery got slightly more out of Alex Iwobi, particularly in the first half of the season, is his off-the-ball movement significantly improved. But, you know, Iwobi is such a confidence player and is still, you know, very much a rough-edged player and isn't really a wide man, despite the fact that that's where he's played.
Yeah, well, you said about playing a diamond, and then you wonder if he played a diamond, whether Iwobi would have found his way onto the pitch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually... Yeah,
he was our Lucas Moura in that respect. I actually think he's been consistently one of our better players in a second half of the season where, admittedly, there wasn't much competition. But he's a player, whenever he comes on, he seems to make an impact.
I think the thing about... I mean, this is a slightly broader discussion, but I think the thing about Alex Iwobi is that he's been played as a winger or at least a wide man for almost all of his Arsenal career. But he isn't really a wide man. You know, his final ball and shooting are both occasionally very good, but also very inconsistent. But I think as a transitional player from the midfield third to the final third, he could be really impressive. I could see him being like a much better version of Moussa Dembele was for Spurs, because he's got more pace and more drive to his game. And I think in a midfield three or a diamond, as being a sort of more advanced, wider player in that role, I think he could be really effective for us going forward.
But it's tricky, because he will need to add a considerable degree of defensive nous to his game to ever be able to play in a midfield three. I think that is his weakest part of his game, is how badly he switches off, actually. Sometimes, he has games where he does well defensively, but for the most part, I think he tends to switch off. Even if he tracks someone back to the final third, it only takes one more pass, and then he's like, oh, it's gone away. And then, meanwhile, his players run into the box and creating carnage.
I mean, it's all about combinations, isn't it? I mean, he'd only work in a midfield three if you've got the other two midfielders are very defensively competent. I mean, that's obvious. But I just think that it's worth experimenting with, particularly in home games against opponents that are going to defend slightly deeper, or when we're playing a slightly more counter-attacking game. Because as you say, it's not just Ozil. The transition of the ball from this Arsenal team, despite a brief improvement at the start of the season under Emery, has been slow.
Even United at their worst, right? You knew if you gave the ball away to them in a position where they had numbers against your limited defence, you'd be shitting yourself. And I can't believe when teams give the ball away against us, they think, here we go. Well, again, and yet that's been such a trademark of Arsenal sides in years gone by.
Yeah, and so much of that is, I mean, it's partly because we don't have players like Bergkamp or Fabregas who would see the pass so early that they could get the ball played for. But it's also we don't have, Iwobi's our only player that can consistently carry the ball over extended period of time. You get moments from
our under challenge. I agree with that, but someone like Aubameyang in a counter-attacking situation, it's made for him, right? Running into yards of space, all you've got, let's say it's 3-on-2, all you've got to do is pull the defenders around into the right position and engineer the chance, but we seem to have lost any ability to do that.
Yeah, and it's one of those interesting things, because obviously a lot of people are equating that with Unai Emery, and it would be fair to say that there are certain elements of that sort of game which have deteriorated a little under him. But you look at the last year and a half of Arsene Wenger, and it was the same as well. And it comes to a point where you're thinking, well, which of these players are capable of playing that kind of football? I mean, going back to the game itself. Obviously, the first goal was vital, as we've discussed, and it was a very well taken goal. And then the second goal was Maitland-Niles was trying to make a break into midfield to start a counter attack, but lost the ball. It looked like a foul to me, and then the space led to another goal with Monreal not tracking Pedro, who's a player that Monreal has always struggled against. Pedro, it's bizarre that Monreal, even in Spain, did so much better against Messi than he did against Pedro. It shows you where his strengths and weaknesses are.
Yeah, but Pedro's quick.
Yeah, well, it's quick, but it's also Pedro's always been brilliant off the ball, whereas Messi generally wanted the ball more to feet until more recent years, where he's improved his off-the-ball play. And then, obviously, the third goal was the real, killer final blow, which by this stage our heads had gone. And that was, unfortunately, Maitland-Niles trying to recover a situation which, it wasn't his fault the situation was there, but his attempts to recover it were rash.
Yeah, to me that just smacked of inexperience and desperation. It was like, rabbit in the headlights moment, and to a certain extent you can almost understand it. So,
of course, particularly
to me though, the point we haven't even touched on yet is, we talked about the importance of that first goal for Chelsea, but how important would it have been if the referee and or VAR had decided that actually the challenge on Lacazette was pen?
Yeah, of course, it would have been a massive impact in the game, in the same way that if Xhaka's shot had just clipped the underside of the bar rather than the top of it.
Yeah, but the difference with that is Xhaka hit the shot, it missed. There's nothing to debate. If it gone in, clearly it would have changed the game, and particularly given the nature of the goal it would have been.
Yeah.
Right-footed screamer.
Yeah.
But in my view, that decision on Kepa or on Lacazette was wrong.
I'm still torn in it, I have to admit, because I look at it and there's definitely contact, but I'm not sure who initiates the contact. That's the thing.
I agree that Lacazette has definitely left his leg trailing. I 100% agree. He has pulled a delete as appropriate Jamie Vardy / Harry Kane / Dele Alli.
It's definitely a Harry Kane special, yeah.
Yeah, the sort of behaviour we see week in, week out in the Premier League, and which when it's against us is literally 99.9% of the time given.
Yeah.
If you look past that, the fact that Lacazette has slightly trailed his leg, to me, there's no doubt that Kepa has come flying out, not got the ball, and, OK, it's not his hands, which probably saved him,
but his head
has knocked Lacazette's leg, which is what causes him to tumble.
Well, this is the thing. It's. I find it a really hard one. Like most times, I'm quite good at forming an opinion about these things. Whether anyone else agrees with me is a different question. But on this one, I watched it, and even during the game, I'm kind of like, is that a penalty?
I thought it was, when it happened live,
but then I thought something doesn't look quite right, but I think it's a penalty. And then when I saw the replay, I was like, so the goalkeeper's caught him with his head on the leg that he's left slightly trailing in. Is that what's caused him to fall over? Was he, you know, it's one of those ones where I find it easier to just
I would like those not to be penalties.
Yeah.
But
the other teams get them all the time.
Current game, yeah. They are. Yeah. So why was it not given?
Well, I think that's the thing, is that what made it interesting in a way was the fact, because it was VAR, if the ref had given it the other way, VAR would have supported the ref.
Yeah.
But because the referee didn't give it, VAR couldn't overrule the referee because it was such a maybe not.
You say that. Even saying that, I think, in the current climate of how penalties are given, you know, you think of some of the handball penalties that have been given, it's just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, don't get me started on that.
In the current climate of giving penalties, to me, that is a clear and obvious error.
Well, that's the thing. I disagree. I think if it's one of those ones that I wanted the penalty, but then if
it was given against you, you'd be angry. And I get that.
Exactly.
But
because
equally, if that was given against you, you'd be saying, he's looking for it, but how flaming stupid by the keeper.
Yeah, but that's partly because we're Stockholm as Arsenal fans to blame our defenders for the bullshit penalties that are given against us every fucking season.
It's not. If your keeper, he wasn't like on goal, was he? You know, he was quite wide. Keeper's gone flying out, not got anywhere near the ball, because let's face it, he's taken Lacazette out after he's kicked the ball and with his leg trailing way behind him.
Yeah, but equally,
nowhere near that ball.
But equally,
he's out of control and he's clipped the player.
But he did withdraw his hands, and the only reason he's clipped the player is because the player's leg was in a position to try and make that contact happen. Now, it's one of those ones that...
But that tells you how late he was, Matthew.
Oh, yeah.
If Lacazette hadn't trailed his leg, he'd actually have missed him altogether by being too far behind him. That's what I mean about it being reckless.
No? Yeah, no, I don't disagree it was reckless, and I don't disagree that Kepa was lucky. I think if Lacazette, having knocked the ball past him, had the ball had been slightly closer to him, it would have made it a lot harder for the referee not to give it. But I think the referee...
See, that's nothing in the rules, is it? There's nothing in the rules about how close the ball is to him.
I know, but we all know that's what they look at. And it's one of those things where there was enough outs for the referee not to give a really big decision early on in a game.
Yeah.
And not enough definite things for the VAR to overrule him. And yet,
if it had been a borderline handball, Matthew, he couldn't have got his finger out of his pocket quick enough.
But that's partly because UEFA have their own special rules about handball, which no one else...
Which apparently we're introducing next season.
Yeah.
Great.
Although, let's not complain about that too much, because, you know, seeing Sissoko Saturday Night Fever getting punished was very, very funny.
Yes, and I actually think... I had a massive argument about this with my mother-in-law, right? My mother-in-law does not watch football, ever.
Yeah.
And yet she had this adamantly strong opinion that was not a penalty. Her little boy, you know, being devastated or something.
What was her reasoning?
That it had hit his chest first.
Yeah, that was... Well, it worked for Glenn Hoddle.
Yeah, Exactly. And to be fair, right, if his arm is anywhere close to a position near his body, you would say, not a pen, clearly, you know, ball's in close proximity, glanced off his chest onto his arm, no big deal. But to me, it's a bit like if they're taking a free kick and you jump with your arms in the air or across your face or whatever, you might not be deliberately contacting the ball, but you have deliberately put your arms in a position where you know they could be struck.
Yeah. I mean,
I actually think if it's across your face, it's bad luck because it would have hit your face anyway. So it's not, you're not gaining advantage from it.
Yeah.
But if you stick your arm out to the side when you are literally, 2 yards tops from a player kicking the ball across your box, what do you think is going to happen?
I did quite like two things about it as a broader discussion and as the incident itself. One, it looked a little bit like Mane was aiming for his arm, which was quite funny.
Good accuracy. Arsenal players would have missed.
But two, it was also the fact that I think what did for Sissoko is, you can have the argument about hit his chest first, therefore it's a bit unlucky, but he did make a very likely instinctive, but he did make an instinctive movement of his arm and shoulder towards the ball.
Well, the irony is, Matthew, he was probably trying to pull his pointing arm back down out the way.
but if he was trying to do that, he did it in a way that wasn't totally consistent with, because what he should do is either move it up out the way or move it back away from the ball, but he actually moved it slightly towards the ball. And so that, again, made it easier for the referee to kind of go, well, if there's any doubt, he still initiated it. Even if it hit his chest first, it wouldn't have hit his arm if he hadn't actually moved his arm slightly towards the ball.
Yeah.
So I think that's what did for him.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you turn around, for example, on the goal line, so you're facing the crowd, but you stand as if you're playing stuck in the mud.
Yeah.
With your arms and legs as far apart as you can. If that ball hits your arm, you did not deliberately contact the ball with your arm, but you deliberately put your arm somewhere you knew it could get hit by the ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, I think, the point with Sissoko.
I mean, it does make you wonder.
He clearly didn't intend.
It does make you wonder what the fuck he was doing with his arms up like that.
Well, exactly. It's from the Kepa school of recklessness, isn't it?
Well, only he was.
All I can say is, Matthew, thank God he did.
Well, exactly, exactly. That's one thing that's been nice, actually, is seeing how many ex-Arsenal players who are not necessarily loved anymore by the fan base coming out and enjoying Spurs losing. I enjoyed Oxlade-Chamberlain milking the moment. I didn't get to play, but that's for all you gooners out there. did you see Fabregas's burn on Graham Roberts?
No.
That was definitely my favourite single Cesc social media moment since he left the club, which is Graham Roberts, Spurs twat extraordinaire of many, many years standing, basically sent a mocking tweet about Arsenal not making the Champions League, and then Cesc waited until after the Champions League final and then just sent a tweet going, I won more than Spurs this year by staying in the studio.
Yes, I did see him partying in the Chelsea changing room, and you do have to wonder if we'd won the trophy, if he'd been in our bloody changing room.
Well, he probably would have it's very interesting, actually, had to be in a situation where he made it very clear to everyone, despite the fact he'd get a medal, loyalties were very divided. So, I mean, I know that lots of...
Yeah, but when you've won a World Cup, what's a Europa League final medal like?
Well, exactly, exactly. And I know that he got he's had a lot of kind of abuse down the years and people calling him a snake for going to Chelsea and all the rest of it. But I've never been able to have any anger towards Fabregas for any of that. I mean, you know, even when he did his first little sonny dive or foul against us for Chelsea, I was like, well, he's always done that. What do you fucking expect? He's always had a bit of the snide about him. He's not going to suddenly stop just to make us feel happy. But anyway.
No, I didn't think he got worse after he went to Barca, but yeah.
Well, I mean...
I suggest we don't open this can of worms, Matthew, because I feel like, I was a big Fabregas fanboy and it nearly broke my heart when he left, so...
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
There's a limited amount of forgiveness that I'm capable of offering.
I suppose maybe after that, seeing the Van Persie moment maybe have numbed me to smaller crimes. But going back to Arsenal then, and leaving such horrors behind, what did you think of the substitutions? I mean, firstly, we have to give away some love for a blinding goal out of nowhere, which was the result of a free kick he won by beating two people as well.
And came when the pressure was completely off.
Yeah, well, exactly, touche. But realistically,
he wants to play in any sort of attacking capacity in our team. He's got to get better at shooting.
I agree.
Or, frankly, passing it anywhere in that final third. So,
well, it's really weird. Like,
he's had a good season without being especially good at that. So just imagine how good he could be if he could add that.
Well, it's also that he occasionally shows moments which, you know, that it's not that he doesn't see it or isn't capable, he just isn't capable of doing it consistently, which suggests there's partly a technical issue, but it's also partly a mental issue.
I think it's massively confidence. I think if he went through a run of games where he scored, you know, let's say two or three goals in five games, it could be the making of him. You know, you think how good Aaron Ramsey's been for us in spells at the club, and then you think how bad he was for stretches of games, particularly after coming back from injuries, and you can just see how big a part confidence can play.
Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously Aaron had that amazing start to the 13-14 season where he went out from being someone who just was coming back and looking like he was getting back to the level that he'd shown he might be, and then suddenly for 6 months or 5 months was the best midfielder in the country by distance. And then that gave him the confidence which, whatever he faced beyond that, he was always able to come back and play effectively, you know, more often than not. And you're right. I mean, I don't think Iwobi's got quite the same technical base to his game as Ramsey does, but I do think, obviously, his physical attributes are potentially very exciting for this team going forward. And then, so obviously, we had the Iwobi impact, and then immediately conceded a very well executed counter-attack goal with appalling defending, as you'd expect. And then we had the Joe Willock for Mesut Ozil substitution, which was sort of seemed just at first sight to be just like a massive fuck you, but then.
And I still think it was, to be honest.
Well, I think it probably was, but at the same time,
it was done at a point in the game where it couldn't possibly make a difference, and the only thing it could ever have done was make Ozil look worse, because if you bring on Willock and he's terrible, everyone goes, "Oh, it's just a kid." And he's come on with no pressure, thinking, well, I've got nothing to lose. I just go, I'm playing in a major European final. I'm just going to go and have some fun with, you know, a couple of other fresh players.
But I think, what I'm saying is, it was clearly like a fuck you substitution, but actually tactically, it worked, not the end result, but it worked out to be a very effective substitution, because it showed us, I mean, from the perspective that in a different way, but Willock actually reminded us why Ramsey would have been such a big fucking addition in this game, because he just ran from deep towards the opposition box, not ahead of the ball, and immediately Chelsea would take their foot off the gas, but immediately we created like three or four chances in the space of about 5 minutes. And of course, he could have scored one, possibly two, if he was a better and more composed finisher. So it sort of was it really served to remind us how the absence of Ramsey, and to a certain extent Mkhitaryan, fucked our game plan against Chelsea.
Yeah, well, I think we've seen it in the last 10 games or so, you know, ever since Ramsey hobbled off. He's a player that in our squad we just do not have anyone who's even close to like for like.
Yeah, and it also shows that in this five at the back formation, how vital it is to have someone outside of the strikers who will try and get into the box, because otherwise we're very easy to defend against from a competently set up defence, because there's no one taking them out of position. I mean, Chelsea just stuck two men on Lacazette, two men on Aubameyang, and then just made sure that Ozil always had company at any given moment. And then just...
Well, even then, they didn't even need to do that, because they knew that as long as Ozil couldn't pass it to Lacazette or Aubameyang, he wasn't likely to shoot himself.
Well, there's that too. But you know, the problem is partly our defence is so weak, our midfield is conservative unless you've got someone like Ramsey that will make those runs, and partly even if our midfield isn't set up so conservatively, there is no one sort of breaking the lines, there's no one pushing, making the opposition do something unexpected or that they don't want to do.
Yeah, well, the other thing Ramsey does is he plays one-touch football, and that just speeds everything up.
Yes.
And Ozil will play one-touch football if he's got someone to play it with, but he won't instigate it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Ozil is one of those players that if you stick him against someone alongside a couple of other brilliant players, he's twice the player. But he can't, you know, he can see...
He can't drag other people's level up when he's an enabler.
No.
And if we're expecting that of him, we're going to be sadly disappointed. I think the concern is that, you know, I've seen a lot of chat about getting rid of Ozil, partly because people find him uninspiring and partly because people think he earns too much money.
Yeah.
The reality is, if he was playing with two or three players around him who, you know, let's say we pulled in a couple of those City players instead, our front five would be absolutely lethal, and we'd be sitting there going, Mesut Ozil's just the master puppeteer that's pulling all the strings of the other four players dancing around him.
Well, I suppose the question... I mean, for me, there's a few different aspects at play. One, I do think, as well as his game slowing down a little bit since the first couple of years he was with us, I think Ozil's... He's been suffering with a few different injuries, the back injuries, and I think his physical explosiveness, not that he was ever explosive, but, you know, he was always one of those players that you were surprised how much ground he covered and how fit he was.
And how quick he is, actually.
Exactly.
When he wants to go fast, he can go fast.
But that has dropped off a little bit, particularly since he's come back into the team this season, and I think it's partly because he's had this back problem. And people have asked questions about his motivation. I mean, hell, I'm not going to speculate about that. It's entirely possible that the clusterfuck of last summer might have affected him mentally, and also being in being asked to play in a style that he's not so enamoured to as to Wenger ball. But I think another massive part of it, quite apart from any drop off in his own personal effectiveness, and hey, we've seen enough players who break into teams at the top level for 18 who by the time they reach their early 30s start to drop off. But there's also the fact of, because we're playing this three-man or five-man defence, however you want to categorise it, we don't have width in the team. And that has always been one of Ozil's greatest strengths for both Real Madrid and Barcelona and Germany, is picking out-to-in runs from wide players, or being able to play wide players in outside the fullback.
AKA Kolasinac, though. That's partly why we've had so much success with Kolasinac. And actually, Xhaka's ended up playing that role to a certain extent in this.
I was just about to say exactly that, yeah. Xhaka's obviously not doing it from as advanced areas, but in terms of spreading the play. But with no wingers in the team, or no wide men of any real description, you know, you look at our best performances this season, it's when we were able to play a back four because we actually had more than two members of a back four who could fucking run. That meant you could play the 4-2-3-1 or maybe a 4-3-3, and suddenly you've got wide players making runs and forming combinations with Ozil or Ramsey around the edge of the box and the front man. You know, it's no coincidence that Iwobi's form and impact, more importantly, has been not as good when there's been no number 10 or anyone playing a number 10 type position in the team, because all he's got to combine with is Kolasinac on the overlap, or trying to play little 1-2s with our two centre forwards, who are neither of them are hold up players. You know, Lacazette has adapted his game as best he can to provide more of that, but that's not what his best qualities are.
Lacazette, who got steamrolled through and stamped on a few times with the referee showing no interest whatsoever.
I mean, that seems to be...
I don't remember who it was. It was Emerson, wasn't it? Someone should have been booked really early on.
Yeah. Emerson...
Terrible.
Emerson fouled him and then left a foot in afterwards, and he got clattered by...
And another foot as well. Stamped on his ankle and then tried to kick him with the follow-through.
Yeah. And David Luiz clattered him a couple of times as well. But Chelsea did that thing that, you know, teams in England know all about, which is get your heavy fouls in early.
Yeah, when the ref's more lenient.
All right, well, we're going to take a pause here because we've talked to death about the Europa League final and we need to move on to other things. We're going to split this into two different podcasts. So we'll pause this one here and we'll come back to you very soon with a second podcast talking about the season as a whole, Unai Emery, and what we think should happen next.